and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. This is Money and Markets with John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. We are recording on Wednesday, October 18th for publication tomorrow, Thursday, October 19th. Our theme, John?
Keep calm and carry on in the kill zone.
Right. And one of the reasons that we chose this theme is we have a situation and we want to do everything we can do to contribute to calming it down. The last thing we wanted is escalating broadly. But the other thing is, it's very important to understand we're watching two populations in terrible danger of genocide and depopulation. And it's important to understand that they're in the center of the kill zone, but we're all in the kill zone now. And if this escalates and we create a real affirmation of genocide, you know, this could spread and affect everybody listening to this call. You know, if it doesn't spread physically, it'll spread through the financial markets. So this is an exceptionally dangerous situation, and it's a good time to keep our wits about us. Any want to add anything to that, John?
Yeah, there's not a lot of there's a lot of heat and a lot of emotion right now, and there's not a lot of lucidity or clarity or coolness, and we're going to try our level best to bring that to you today. But that said, it's a very good show we put together. We put some time into this one.
Yep. Okay, let's go.
Let's go. Let's dive in. And the first story right out of the gate, Catherine, is in sort of an epicenter of the kill zone. And to me, for my money, this is the most fascinating story of the week. This is from a guy, Jonathan Cook, who's been writing on the Middle East for a long time. And it's called Lawless in Gaza, Why Britain and the West Back Israel's Crimes. This is the 13th, so it's Friday the 13th. And he talks about what the real function of Gaza is. This is interesting. More than a decade ago, Israel started to understand that its occupation of Gaza through siege could be to its advantage. Specifically, Israel could use Gaza to develop all sorts of new technologies and strategies associated with the homeland security industries burgeoning across the West, as officials there grew increasingly worried about domestic unrest, sometimes referred to as populism. Does that ring a bell?
Mm-hmm.
How could the population best be contained? What restrictions could be placed on their diet and lifestyle? How were networks of informers and collaborators to be recruited from afar? What effect did the population's entrapment and repeated bombardment have on social and political relations? The answers to those questions were made available to Western allies through Israel's shopping portal, referring to Gaza. Items available included interception rocket systems, electronic sensors, surveillance systems, drones, facial recognition, automated gun towers, and much more, all tested in real-life situations in Gaza. Israel's standing took a severe dent from the fact that Palestinians managed to bypass this infrastructure of confinement last weekend, at least for a few days, with a rusty bulldozer, some hang gliders, and a sense of nothing to lose, which is part of the reason Israel now needs to go back into Gaza with ground troops to show that it still means to keep the Palestinians crushed. And that's about the tightest and most interesting summary I've seen of what's going on over there.
So if you go back and look at Whitney Webb's coverage of Israeli contractors taking the lead on building cyber digital control, you know, and marketing into the U.S. defense networks. But we've also seen Netanyahu consistently bragging about wanting to be the leader in the digital control grid. So the idea of using both Gaza and Israel to prototype this stuff, you know, of course they've been doing that. And if you want to understand the 15-minute cities and what's in store, you know, look here for the prototype. And so if you're upset about the 15-minute cities, you know, you're looking at the people who are making a massive contribution to building that infrastructure and making money on building that infrastructure.
Right.
Right. You know, and I go back to, you know, we're not talking about the Israeli people. We're talking about the crime syndicate involved here. So
yeah, right. You got that.
Right.
We'll see that. We'll see that in a minute. And it helps as far as the 15-minute city is concerned.
Right.
That's a great point. And it's worth keeping in mind that the size of Gaza, if you're an American, it's, you know, it's about equal to Central Park in Manhattan.
Right.
It's same ballpark.
It's small.
It's small.
Yeah. So we're, you know, among other things, and we'll talk about it when we get to looking at Pfizer and Pfizer stock, we're talking about, you know, these are not different syndicates. This is one syndicate. This is the control syndicate, an yes. intimate part of the digital control syndicate.
Right. Okay. Now, next door, you mentioned there's danger to both sides, you right. know, whichever side of Gaza you're on, inside or outside, danger all around. You know, good information is hard to come by. And last week we talked about really not a lot of documentary, photo or video evidence to back up sort of the narrative of sort of a civilian slaughter and rampage. So I had poked around and there are photos on both sides. And I'm not going to poke through the photos. I'm going to show the article from the AP. These photos show fear, death, and destruction and battle scenes from Israel and the Gaza Strip. And this is one of those kind of a photo montage. That one's not so bad. But notice that this is in the file there, if you can't read it, is an Israeli soldier stands by the bodies of Israelis killed by Palestinian armed militants who entered from the Gaza Strip. That photo, like a lot of others in this montage, and there are some 37 in the sequence, a lot of them are outside. And a lot of reports I've read are Palestinians broke out of Gaza with, like they said, bulldozers and minibikes. And a lot of the deaths that occurred were in crossfire, which explains why so many of those photos are outside. That's consistent with the crossfire narrative. And there are some grim photos. That's probably the tamest one I just showed, and I'm going to cut it there. But a lot of those photos are outside, which is consistent with the crossfire story.
Right.
But that said, there's one photo in this sequence that's inside a kibbutz. It's seven dead bodies, very gruesome, consistent with the slaughter story. So it all kind of boils down to, you know, do you trust the AP and the captions for what they're saying, or don't you? That's really kind of, but make no mistake, there are photos of dead bodies inside around the time of October 7th, to be sure.
Right, right. What was astonishing to me was people in Israel reporting the speed at which they were getting photos on their smartphone. And yeah. I was very concerned after listening to them talk that there was a targeted campaign to send them things that looked like they were grassroots but weren't, and were filled with entrainment and subliminal programming and other kinds of stuff. Right. It felt to me like this was really a campaign.
There is a feel to that, and the media right. has been caught again and again and again. That photo inside the kibbutz is shot with a very tight lens, so it's way focused in on one room. You can't see really, you have no clue but as to where it is. And the media has been caught again and again and again repurposing old photos from Syria in 2020, from Guatemala right. in 2005, and right. saying this occurred in Israel. You know, the gloves are off as far as the media is right. concerned and its veracity.
Right. Well, I think, aren't we going to cover the story that both the prime minister's office and the generals had to unwind?
You have to refresh my recollection.
The decapitated babies?
Yes. We're gonna do that one right now.
Okay, let's go.
We'll cut to that one right now. And again, this is one of those days, Catherine and I talked about it shortly before the recorder on this program. The information is hard to come by. And so a lot of the stories we're using today are from official sources. Because you can kind of look at official sources as almost an admission, where if you don't trust the third parties, see what the officials are saying and watch what the officials are doing. And a lot of times that'll give you a much better clue as to what's going on. And that's certainly the case with the next story, which is actually a video clip. So let me roll this clip. This is President Biden talking about the decapitated babies. Here we go.
I never really thought that I would see and have confirmed pictures of terrorists beheading children. I never thought I'd ever. Anyway, but there are countries in the region that are trying to be of some help, including Arab nations, who are trying to be of some help. So Anyway.
So there you go. Biden claiming. There you go. Biden claiming to have seen the photos. But I want you to notice something. I'm going to point this out here. For my money, that's some Obama-level scripting right there. He actually doesn't come out and say he saw photos. He heavily implies it. Right. He says, I never thought I'd see.
Right.
He didn't say he saw them.
Right, exactly.
Okay. And that's an Obama classic lawyering.
Smooth operator.
It's very smooth, but get a load of the next story. This is from, it's from the New York Post via the Washington Post. But the White House has to walk back the claim that he saw the beheaded babies. He didn't. Here we go. Biden did not actually see confirmed pictures of terrorists beheading children, as he claimed, White House clarifies. Neither the president nor U.S. officials have seen images or heard independently confirmed reports of beheaded children, a White House spokesperson later clarified, according to the Washington Post. Clarify within an hour, I should point out. The White House says Biden based his remark on claims made by a spokesman for Israel Prime Minister in media reports coming out of the Jewish state. And then you have this reporter here, Nicole Zedek, a TV reporter for Tel Aviv-based I-24 News, first reported the child beheading allegations Tuesday and said in a radio interview Wednesday that she's appalled by initial public skepticism. I guess that would include the White House, which ran away from her claim because nobody's seen anything. Now, Blinken said he saw one photo of one child, and that was it. He didn't say it was beheaded. It was shot. The child was shot. But the 24 story has just been debunked. The White House has run away from itself because it's not true. No support for it.
Right, but I'm sure before it got bunked, it spread quickly. Because I knew people who were picking it up that weekend.
Yeah.
So, but you know, what I read was the journalist claimed that it was confirmed by a general and the PM's office. So, you know, again... Nope. Here we are with, you know, just unbelievable. I mean, we're in a situation where essentially you can trust nothing other than, you know, if I talk to somebody in Israel who I know and trust, then I feel like, okay, that's reasonable information. But
right.
I don't trust anything coming from anybody. And the problem with, you know, years and years and years of lying and official narrative lying is, we're now in a situation where nobody is, you know, it's impossible to trust anything you're hearing.
You got it.
Right.
And your sense of outrage that no one believes you and is skeptical of your story is completely misplaced. You've done this to yourself. You've been lying for a decade or more. And now people are like throwing up their hands. Like, I don't believe a word you say.
Right. It's the little boy who cried wolf. So you,
bingo. That's right. That's a perfect description of it. The right. Boy who cried wolf. What we got now. It's like, well, you know, maybe it's here, maybe it's not, but no one's believing you either way.
Right.
But let's turn our next story. This is one, again, it's official source that I do believe. Stunning State Department memo warns diplomats, no Gaza de-escalation talk. So the U.S. is not in favor of de-escalation. The State Department is discouraging diplomats working on Middle East issues for making public statements, suggesting the U.S. wants to see less violence. According to internal emails viewed by Huffington Post, State Department staff wrote to high-level officials do not want press materials to include three specific phrases, de-escalation slash ceasefire, end to violence slash bloodshed, and restoring calm. Don't write those. The emails were sent hour after Israel told more than 1.1 million residents of northern Gaza that they should leave their homes and shelters ahead of an expected ground invasion of the region.
Right. And I would note, I don't know if you saw it, but both Jordan and Egypt have now said they're not taking significant refugees.
I caught that this morning. They're not taking refugees. And that's going to open the door to shift the focus of blame from Israeli troops invading northern Gaza and shuttling people out of their homes, which is a war crime straight up. That's a completely non-controversial statement. Moving people en masse out of their homes is a war crime. Well, it's well recognized around the world. But it's going to now focus will shift to all those bad Egyptians for not taking, or Jordanians or whoever, for not taking the refugees. I mean, Anyway, I want to cut back to one last thing in that story, and that's this. Israel's operation in Gaza has killed nearly 1,800 people so far, the Gazan Health Ministry said Friday, including 583 children and 351 women. And this is the tell there, that these are not troops. These are civilians. Again,
right.
Undisputed right. War crime. No question about that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going with another story. This is a very recent story, and we just added it today, this morning. And I'm going to show you a tweet. And this concerns Israel's alleged bombing of the hospital in Gaza. Again, if true, that's you targeted a hospital with civilians, that's absolutely a war crime. And there's been some debate about whether or not that's true. And you yourself, Catherine, noted that it's really hard to find, you know, good information. I'm going to show you.
I have to tell you, under these circumstances, I believe there's a reasonable chance it was a third party who did it.
Okay. That's a very reasonable question. We will concede that's an open question.
Right.
But I want to show you a tweet from Israel's officialdom. Israel's own digital spokesperson, appointed by Netanyahu himself, literally admitted to bombing the hospital and then deleted the tweet a few minutes later. Here he is. Naftali here says, breaking, Israeli Air Force struck a Hamas terrorist base inside a hospital in Gaza. A number of terrorists are dead. It's heartbreaking that Hamas is launching rockets from hospitals, mosques, schools, using civilians as human shields. But, you know, notice like Israel being the perpetual victim here focuses on that and blows right past this part. It's like Israel, the Air Force, struck inside a hospital in Gaza. So the cover story there as well, it was the terrorist base inside the hospital. No one will ever be able to verify that because of hospital was totally annihilated and hundreds of people were dead.
Right.
Yeah. So there's little doubt about that. But that brings us to the next story. So your own guy admitted it. Okay. That's an official source. You admitted it. But that, let's cut to President Biden. We've already caught him sort of lying, even though technically it wasn't a lie, about the dead beheaded babies, which there's no support for whatsoever. Now let's go to Biden talking about the Gaza hospital. And look what he says here in a summit that includes Netanyahu.
You know, years ago, I asked the Secretary of State when he and I were working in the Senate to write something for him, and said, he wrote a line that I think is appropriate. He said, it's not, we need not just, well, I won't go into it, I'll wait later. Taking too much time, but the point is this, that I'm deeply saddened and outraged by the explosion at the hospital in Gaza yesterday. And based on what I've seen, it appears as though it was done by the other team, not you.
Wow. So, you know, Biden taking Israel's side right away on that one, on the Gaza. Based on what? We don't know.
So, you know, I hate to say this. First of all, I don't think Israel's being run by the Israelis. You know, I have a strong feeling that there is a criminal syndicate at work here, and they're trying to start World War III, and our job is to stop them from pulling it off.
Yeah, that's a great point, and that cuts right to our next story. Is now let's look at what some other nations are doing, because one of the signposts of an imminent world war is there's two clear poles.
Right.
There's two polarities. There's the North Pole and the South Pole, and whatever you want to call it, left and right, up and down,
right,
divided. And we're starting to see those divisions are, you know, that invasion was the 7th. We're recording on the 18th. That's 11 days ago. And already the divisions are clear, left and right.
Right. Well, there's polarity, but remember, when it comes to doing CBDCs under the BIS, they're all in there together working on it, okay?
Yeah.
So it's not clear to me exactly how this polarity works.
Right, but the polarity I'm talking about is a polarity we've referred to again and again and again on Money and Markets, and that's, let's call it the Global South, the BRICS nations on the one half, and the U.S. and the West on the other, on the other side.
Right.
And now I want to show you one clip. This is from a Chinese... a foreign minister talking about, you know, his view on the conflicts. Let's run this.
巴勒斯坦问题始终是中东问题的核心，是当今世界不断对撕开的伤痕。这些问题的根源在于巴勒斯坦独立建国的夙愿迟迟没有能够得到纠正。以色列有建国的权利，巴勒斯坦同样有建国的权利。以色列人得到了生存的保障。 巴勒斯坦人的生存，血缘关系。以色列的民族已经不在世界上颠沛流离。巴勒斯坦民族何时才能重返家园？这个世界存在各种不公，而对巴勒斯坦的不公已经延宕了大半个世纪，承接了几代人的痛苦，不能再继续下去了。Okay.
I should point out here the other, we're not going to run the clips, but there's other nations that have lined up right on China's side. One's Russia, another's Croatia. There's any number of others that aren't on Israel's side on this, they're on Palestine's side.
Right. Although I would love to ask the Chinese about the Tibetans.
Right.
The, you know, part of the process we're coming into is all of our hypocrisies are going to come to the surface and be questioned.
Right, and that may be a good thing, you know.
Yep.
The more hypocrisies that surface, the better off we all are.
Yep.
But that's a growing indication that we're queuing up a world war here, is the clear polarization around a single issue.
Well, here's the problem. The problem is if the Israelis government or the crime syndicate does what it says it's going to do, you know, then you have an all-out war crime. You are attacking civilians,
right,
for the acts of terrorists.
You don't even need to attack them. You just need to shun them out of their homes. That's enough.
Right, right.
Right.
Okay.
Anyway, but I'm with you. I think this is really more about world war, and I think that's where we're headed. And I don't think this is, yeah, this isn't about an argument over a parking space. There's a lot more over, you know, that's a line from a movie. I can't remember what. There's a lot more going on here. And the next story illustrates this probably better than any other, certainly the best one that I found along all the stories that you and I looked at this week. And this is from Al Jazeera. Israel cripples Syria's two main airports in strikes, says Syrian state media. Damascus and Aleppo airports knocked out of service. Israel launched missile strikes on Syria's two main airports in Damascus and the northern city of Aleppo, knocking out service. Syria says the damage includes landing strips in the two airports, put them out of service, state news agency Sana said on Thursday. The Israeli military, which does not typically comment on its operations, did the same thing here, did not release any immediate statement on the attacks. Interestingly, though, in May, Israel air raids struck Aleppo airport, killing three people and putting the facility out of commission. Obviously, May predates this controversy by quite a bit. Israel has been at work on Syria for some time, and it's just continuing now. But
who are they worried is going to supply, who's going to land planes that supply someone?
The claim is that Iran is supplying Syria with whatever weapons that Israel is claiming. That's the claim.
Right.
But you have to wonder whether Russian S-400 defense system is going to be installed over there as a result of this. Anyway, it's a broader conflict than just Hamas, than just Palestine, and just Gaza. There's a lot more going on here. And the spillover of this into Syria, among other places, is very clear.
Right. The big piece is the U.S. versus Iran or China.
The big piece is the U.S. versus Iran and China. And on that score, you know, we're not running a story this week, but the U.S. has sent over both the USS Gerald Ford and the Eisenhower to two massive aircraft carriers that support basically an ecosystem of, you know, jet fighters to that region. And it's like, well, again, you know, and you're sending 2,500 troops. Now they're saying it's non-combat troops, but it's 2,000 or 2,500. But this isn't just about Gaza, is it?
Right. No.
There's a, and by the way, I saw a video this morning of Putin responding, saying, this isn't a threat, he says, and then he issues the threat. I must remind you that our Kinzhal weapons can be launched from as far as the Black Sea, and they have 1,000. All he said is, like, we can launch Kinzhal weapons and super hypersonic weapons from the Black Sea, and they have 1,000-kilometer range. And if you look at a map, you'll find that Gaza is about 950 kilometers from the Black Sea.
Right.
So he, you know, this is not looking good as far as world war is concerned. For Putin, I was stunned when I saw that, and he said it's not a threat. I mean, stop being cute, Putin. It is a threat.
Right.
Of course it's a threat. Anyway. So this is serious. Things are serious, and it's not limited. I mean, it's serious what's going on in Gaza, but the spillover here, the writing is on the wall as far as spillover is concerned. This is, you know, we said this last week, it's spinning out of control as we speak.
Right, but the thing that most concerns me is everyone or many of the discussions that I'm connected to or I listen to, you have people who feel a lot of passion, but they don't see how it fits into the, you know, their lives and how it's going to reverberate into their lives. So, yeah. You know, so I see way too much passion and not enough good maps of understanding what this means to, you know, the people there and the people here.
Right.
That's why, you know, that's why the theme, keep calm and carry on in the kill zone. We're all in the kill zone. We need to keep our wits about us.
You got to keep cool, and you got to stay rational, and you got to think. You got to use your head.
Right.
You don't get swept up. Don't take the bait. Keep your head about you. That's exactly right. And one of the pieces in this is the capacity of both the U.S. and Russia, frankly, to you know, how much war capacity do you have? How much bandwidth do you have? How much killing bandwidth do you have? And that's our next story from war in Ukraine. This is interesting. From Reuters, Russia pummels East Ukrainian town of Avdiivka. I'm just going to say Avdiivka. I'm going to try to get that V in there. Avdiivka, in heavy fighting. Okay. This is a key town, and this has been going on a while. Russian forces pummeled the eastern Ukrainian town of Avdiivka. Ukraine says, and this is a key town because it's near Donetsk. Ukraine said its forces were holding their ground, but Berbash, this is the head of Avdiivka military administration, said the town was under constant attack from air, artillery, and a large number of troops. And here's where you see kind of the emotional part here. Avdiivka is home to a big coking plant and has become a symbol of resistance, as it has prevented Russia from taking full control of the Donetsk region, which Russia says it has annexed. The Russians threw a lot of forces in this direction. They are betting on quantity. Our army is holding positions in heavy fighting. Yermak, the head of presidential office, wrote on X social media, Avdiivka, a Ukrainian city, our land. So line in the sand, Avdiivka. Berbash, that same guy, estimated Thursday, get the load of these numbers, that some 1,600 residents remain in Avdiivka, which had a pre-war population of 32,000. So that's a 95% reduction.
Half gone.
In the town. And Russia is still fighting. They have not taken that over. By every report I've read, they haven't right. taken it yet. So Ukraine is dug in, and this begs the question of, you know, how can Russia really afford an all-out battle in the Middle East? You can't take over a town of 1,600 people? Probably not.
So it's important to remember that winter is coming. And, you know, if you look at what's happened so far in the Ukraine, this is potentially going to be a very dangerous and horrible winter. You know, I don't know how much crops they've been able to lay into storage, but I doubt it's their usual harvest.
Right.
So, and winter's going to be tough for Russia in the Ukraine and the Ukrainians in the Ukraine. So, and I come back to the theme of depopulation, because that's my concern for the Ukraine. I think that's one of the goals.
Yeah. Right. That it's hard to avoid that conclusion more and more. I want to run one video on Ukraine on Avdiivka. And this is from somebody from a very pro-Ukrainian viewpoint. Just to kind of round this out, let's run this. Got a map here of the disputed area.
What seems to be true about this map is the areas of attack. That is accurate. The attack's coming from the north and south in an attempt to quickly encircle Avdiivka. So far, Ukraine reports that the front lines have held, with Russia gaining some ground to the north and south, but not capturing any major settlements yet. But things are certainly tense there. The most concerning thing for me from this region are these videos here showing helicopters flying operations over the area at will. This seems to indicate a severe lack of SAM coverage for Ukraine here, and this seems to be true all across Ukraine. Russian drones are operating much more freely now, even pretty far back behind the lines. Now, we're seeing helicopter operations with no confirmed or reported shootdowns of any of the helicopters that took part in this attack.
Very interesting.
So right, Russia's they got don't free have weapons. They're out of weapons. They're
out of weapons. And right. Russia's got free reign over the sky. But that begs the question, like, what's the holdup in Avdiivka?
I don't know. You know, we have reports, issues of getting resources to the Ukraine, and the UK saying they're planning on tapping the interest on the Russian seized assets. So now remember, yeah. Let's step back. We still have a fight for the speaker in the US House. And even Yellen has said, until we get a speaker, the spigot can't open, right? Whether it's for the Ukraine or Israel. And we just saw Jim, you know, Scalise lost the vote and stepped down. Then Jordan came back. He just lost the vote yesterday. And big question mark of, you know, can we get a speaker? And until we get a speaker, the spigot doesn't turn on. And I would say, you know, if that's the case, somebody doesn't want the spigot to turn on.
A reasonable question.
Right.
Like, what's holding things up? I mean, and that gets to our next story. We've seen
that. Even if the speaker holds up the U.S. spigot, the U.K. can turn on its spigot if it wants.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's not insignificant.
Right.
But without Uncle Sam, and maybe that's the kind of political pressure that gets the U.S. to move in that direction. I don't know, but you're right. The spigot isn't turning on yet, and it's not going to turn on. That's a great point. Until you get a House Speaker.
Right.
You know, you've got a tourniquet on. But anyway, there's a question. There's a reasonable question about Russia's military capacity, given the dug-in situation of Avdiivka. But let's turn to the U.S. next, ask the same question with the U.S. is, can the U.S. support two wars?
Now, before we go there, let me just point out Putin was over in Beijing hugging Xi Jinping. They look very friendly. So
there's no doubt they're on the same side in this one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's ask the commander in chief whether the U.S. can fight two wars at the same time. Here we go.
Are the wars in Israel and Ukraine more than the United States can take on at the same time?
We're the United States of America, for God's sake. The most powerful nation in the history, not in the world, in the history of the world. The history of the world. We can take care of both of these and still maintain our overall international defense. We have the capacity to do this, and we have an obligation to. And if we don't, who does?
So no question in his mind that we can tie one hand behind our back and whip these guys.
So inspired by our discussion yesterday about this, I went and looked at the full video on Yellen saying, yes, absolutely, we can afford both wars. And of course, I have to say, any government official who opines on these issues, if they have dual citizenship, they need to disclose it. That's number one.
Agreed.
But number two, Yellen was very convincing. It was the best Yellen I've seen in terms of convincing on a questionable position. But what was very interesting, she segued in the middle of the conversation, and I've sent the video in for posting in our news, trends, and story section. She segues to talking about the fact that there's $7 trillion owed in back taxes, and the Treasury has provided $60 million to the IRS to go collect this over the next few years. And the notion of the Treasury sending out agents all around the United States to pony up $7 trillion from the general population You know, that's a very chilling thought, particularly given there's $21 trillion missing from the U.S. Treasury.
Right. No word about that. We're going to let that one go.
So, and you can see what, you know, as she says this, what you realize is no wonder the fight on the Second Amendment and free speech is so intense right now. You know, they need no First and Second Amendment if they're going to go seize $7 trillion of the general population's bank accounts and assets. But it's very chilling to watch. And her conversation is, of course, we can afford this because we have $7 trillion of accounts payable from the American people and we're going to go get it.
That's not why she's saying that. But I mean, I get that's what she's saying. And she's giving you a heads up on that. There's another reason altogether why she's saying that.
Oh, yeah.
But
go ahead.
We'll get to that. And well, it's because they know that the Fed can buy directly from directly from the U.S. government. And that's going to solve a lot of problems. They just haven't done it yet.
Right.
They've let the U.S. spiral in all this debt unnecessarily.
They haven't done it overtly.
Yeah, fair enough.
I will bet you a dollar that they've already done it covertly.
Okay, well, if they have done it covertly and haven't announced it, that dollar's not worth a whole lot, is it? Why don't we bet like a gram of gold?
Okay. Okay. I'll bet you the Soleri silver that
I think I happen to have one right at my desk.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, I'll bet you another one.
Okay. Okay, let's keep it going with Bidenomics from Zero Hedge, talking about turning the spigot on to give you an idea of where we are. They say Bidenomics. It's not really. It would be Trumponomics too. But here's the national debt increases by another $500 trillion in just 20 days. This is astonishing. On September 15th, the debt quietly blew past $33 trillion. On October 5th, which is 20 days later, it pushed above $33.5 trillion. Feast your eyes in this graph, America's finances.
Right.
Here you go. The red is debt over time. Okay. And look, it's just exploding over here. But this is, look at this. The crusher in this graph is revenue takes a nosedive starting down. And because of that nosedive, the deficit is just rocketing, which is, you can see the spike it's putting on the debt.
Right.
That's kind of a scary graph. And that's really, the spigot's going to be on no matter what due to that graph.
So I want everybody to go online and, you know, I just finished reading on the plane flying over to the Pennsylvania, John, your book on the seven financial conspiracies, which is excellent. What a great book that is. So I really appreciate the heads up, but
hard to believe. I mean, who wrote that? It's a woman, like an evangelical woman from the late 1800s.
Right.
It's like, what?
But her father had really figured out the games around the Civil War and then the games after, you know, the legislation and the games afterwards and the real hit on the country. And he taught her and then she wrote it up and really, she does a great job. But
her explanations are so crystal clear.
She goes into aspects of the greenbacks that I hadn't realized. But everybody go online and take a look at greenbacks. So, you know, in our history, the Treasury has issued currency. And just understand, we have $33 trillion of debt, but if we'd had greenbacks and issued those instead, we'd have zero debt and zero interest expense. Right. And there's no reason why we can't do that.
There's no reason we can't do that, but the Fed is going to do it in a way that inserts the Fed into the equation and they retain control.
Right, and it puts us in a debt trap.
But it puts us in a debt, and it keeps us in the dark.
Right. It keeps us in the dark. It puts us in a debt trap. And the part of that darkness includes, where did the $21 trillion disappear to?
Yeah. There's a lot, right? There's a lot of darkness, and the Fed would retain control under its scheme. I'm going to make a video about this. It'll probably be my next video to sort of correct last video. But anyway, that's a story for another day. For now, let's turn to charts on the dollar since we've seen the debt there exploding.
Right.
I think you ponied up three charts this week. Let's look at them, starting with the 30-year Treasury yield.
Yeah, so the Treasury yield is touching, on the 30-year, is touching 5%. It's at 4.95% this morning. But if you come in short on the yield curve, it's up over 5. And so you've now got a slightly downward sloping yield curve from within the 1 year period and the intermediate down to the long term, which is kind of implying maybe we get some deflation. But needless to say, capital is no longer cheap. And what you're watching all around the world, John, is people who invested or proceeded with projects that were economic when capital was essentially at 0 to 1%. You know, now that interest rates are high, they're really feeling the pain. So, yeah. And we see that pain in the U.S. commercial real estate market. We're seeing it all around the world because
all around
now
the, world. Yeah.
The rules have changed, both the cost of capital and the cost of energy. And those two things together are putting the squeeze on a lot of people, a lot of families, a lot of homes, and a lot of businesses.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And a lot of smaller nations around the world.
Yes.
Developing nations, big time, yeah. Big time pain. Okay, let's go to our next graph. The 20-plus year ETF, Treasury ETF year to date. Look at that. What's going on?
Yeah, so it's down 50% from its high. This is just the year to date chart,
right?
Which will show you how much it's dropped. And of course, as interest rates rise, long bonds go down. And this has been devastating, yep. Because many retirees, sort of the elder generation, you know, they've been taught as they age to move from stocks to bonds. And of course, so it's called the 60-40 portfolio. The 60-40 portfolio ain't working. And and so if you had a lot of money in long, if you're in short treasuries, it's fine. If you're in long treasuries, it's not fine. And it's been very painful. And of course, that includes pain at the banks who didn't hedge their investment portfolios because they're heavily into treasuries. And if they went out in the long maturities and they didn't hedge, then, you know, they're hurting. And we talked about that with the SVB.
And that's because, correct me if I'm wrong, that's because if you bought a long treasury, you got a lot of time left on the clock and it's something playing 1%. There's not much of a market for 1% instruments right now in
right.
a 5%
and you have,
environment.
You have that, to a certain extent, you have that problem on your loan portfolio, but you also have that problem on your investment portfolio. Now, we just saw some of the big banks announce, you know, glorious earnings. So JP Morgan Chase is doing well, and that's because they're making a lot of money on higher interest rates. So, if you can play it right, then you're going to make more money on the higher interest rates as well. And that can
they're also JP Morgan making a good penny on crime. We'll get to that in a minute.
Well, that's not a story because that's not new, John.
That's true. That's like a chapter out of the modern U.S. textbook. Let's go to the last chart, U.S. dollar index since BlackRock gave its paper at Jackson Hole in 2019.
So the dollar's up and it looks strong, but I would say it's not strong for all the reasons we know from looking at the geopolitics and what is happening at the Middle East. You know, my guess is that all the countries in the dollar debt trap are selling treasuries to raise money for carrying their debt. And we're clearly seeing the Chinese and people who don't, you know, want to be over US dollar barrels, you know, selling their treasuries and using the money to buy real assets. And it's no different. I just recorded the equity overview yesterday and I kept saying something I've said for 3 years, that the long-term bull in the bond market is over and get out of, you know, paper denominated in fiat currency and get into real assets. So, you know, you've got a lot of people around the world who are holding dollars and they're watching what's happening in the Middle East and it gets scary. Now, remember when, I think we mentioned this last week, Hamas says, you know, not only a global jihad, but a financial jihad. If you look at all the treasuries owned, you know, the big holder of treasuries is the U.S. pension funds and retirement funds. But if you look at all the treasuries that the Muslim nation sovereign wealth funds and reserves hold, it's an extraordinary amount. And if that were really to happen, which I don't expect, but if it were, you know, then you're talking about treasuries piling into the Fed like nothing you've ever seen. And in fact, when we looked at that paper that said the dealers can't handle the inventory, that's the kind of inventory they're worried about.
Right. Between you and me, I think that paper, though, about the dealers not being able to handle this or that is kind of a cover for the Fed to say, hey, look, this guy discovered that we could do it another way and we could just buy up, we can soak up all the treasury we want with impunity.
So here, Here's what I have to say. If you look at all the games I think the Fed has been playing, and I shouldn't say the Fed, the New York Fed has been playing to get the dealers to carry, you know, as the inventory, when we go through periods where the inventory goes up, they have all sorts of things they can do, you know, very behind the scenes to help the dealers carry it. And I think they think the politics of that is getting a little too nerve-wracking. And I agree with you, they want air cover to just buy direct. But they also have a real management problem because it can get very sensitive, and all they need is one Yahoo at one bank to cause problems, and you could get a real mess. So I think they want much tighter control of, you know, I think they want to relieve the pressure on that inventory, and they want to maintain control, particularly if they get this kind of deluge.
And I think they also want to, me, it indicates they're not backing off on the interest rates because they know they don't have to. In the end, they could just buy treasuries direct and get around any interest rate problem because the interest would recycle right back into the U.S. coffers.
This is the going direct reset, pals, playing hardball. That's the game.
Yep.
Welcome to hardball.
And it's more and more control, exactly like you said.
Right.
But let's go to the next story about J.P. Morgan from Wall Street on Parade. Janet Yellen's Treasury Department hires five-count felon J.P. Morgan Chase to look for fraud. Like, are you kidding me? Is this The Onion? According to a press release posted on J.P. Morgan Chase's website, it has been designated by the United States Treasury Department under a financial agency agreement to provide account validation services for federal government agencies in order to ensure Treasury's commitment to payment integrity and the reduction of improper payments. Surely you jest. Since 2014, J.P. Morgan Chase has admitted to five separate criminal felony charges brought by the U.S. Department of Justice. What are we talking about here? This is an example. This is a separate case. So five felonies, or that's undisputed. But this is the most interesting part of this article. There's a case now pending against J.P. Morgan. A former J.P. Morgan Chase attorney whistleblower charged in a federal lawsuit filed 2 years ago that the bank was making improper payments to politically connected parties and hiding the payments through dodgy accounting. The plaintiff in the case is Shaquala Williams, an attorney and financial crimes compliance professional with more than a decade of experience at multiple global banks. Williams says in her suit that J.P. Morgan Chase was keeping two sets of books and effectively making a monkey out of the DOJ by brazenly flouting the non-prosecution agreement it had signed with the DOJ in a previous case. But get this, it came out in Williams' deposition testimony that one of the people being paid under her allegation of two separate sets of books was Tony Blair.
Why does that not surprise anyone?
That is a serious second set of books there.
Right.
How much money are we talking about?
$21 trillion is missing. Okay. You can pay a lot of kickback.
That goes a long way.
That 21 trillion goes a long way. And, you know, if you look at the lead banks at the New York Fed and the owners, so JP Morgan Chase and Citibank are the most powerful owners of the New York Fed, and they act as agent for all sorts of stuff, including at both of the agencies where the 21 trillion is missing. So JP Morgan Chase is up to its eyeballs in shenanigans in the federal economy. This is so simple as a legal matter. If you owned a stock in a company and that company since 1998 had refused to comply with the laws related to audited financial statements and had massive reports of money missing and refused to, you know, go find it or document it or clean up their books, so they were in complete violation of all the laws related to their financial statements, would you assume that everything was on the up and up and okay?
I'd wipe you out of that company in 3 seconds flat.
Right.
If they said something like that. That's like saying I'm a pathological liar. I take medication for being a pathological liar, but I'm not going to tell you whether I'm on
medication. But make no mistake about it. Every pension fund in the country has continued to buy treasuries. And most everybody I know in their retirement accounts is buying treasury bills or going to Treasury Direct or asking me if they should buy I-bonds. So we're financing an organization that's completely outside of all the laws related to financial management.
Right, right. You're financing a company that is above the law, basically. It's not subject to laws.
Right. But it's depository. It has one bank account. Just like you have a bank account, I have a bank account. The U.S. government has a bank account. That bank account, their banker is the New York Fed. And the New York Fed is owned by its members, of which the two most powerful are J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank. So they own the banker from which $21 trillion that we know of and probably more has disappeared from. We don't know if it's more because they changed the rules. So that since from 2015, the accounts just are dark. We have no idea.
Right. That's a great point because it begs the question, like, well, who's really the top dog here? Second set of books, really.
The and you didn't know, control,
and the Fed, the New York Fed didn't notice that. Did there a second set of books?
The people who control the financial transaction train tracks are in control. That's why J.P. Morgan Chase controlled Madoff. They controlled the money. They controlled the bank account. They controlled the transaction. And when we talk about criminal syndicates, just remember what the DEA told Kelly Amiro, who told me after lunch. He said, let's face it, honey, all the wires batch and go through the New York Fed. They know where every penny is.
Yeah, I think that's totally right.
Right.
You know, Madoff kept $5 billion on account at J.P. Morgan. That money was uninsured.
$6 billion uninsured.
Whatever it was, all of it, except for $100,000, because that was the limit back then, all of it was uninsured.
Right.
Why would he? But he knew he wasn't taking any risk because he knew that the money was basically sitting with the ruler of the U.S.
Right.
That's one way to look at that.
I would say Lockheed, you know.
Okay.
Again, central bank warfare, they got to play together.
Right? They do. Yep. Okay, let's return to the theme of, you know, they're all on the same team. And that's this next story, even though we're moving into CBDC and really kind of Hey Robot segment of our program. This is out of Sweden, this next story, and it shows why you want to go to cash. But look at their point of view on this. Very interesting. They're coming to the same conclusion for very different reasons. Here, the story is about this guy who says, Putin could switch everything off. How cashless Sweden went too far. The guy up there in that picture is former head of Interpol, Bjorn Eriksson. And he spent much of his professional life hunting criminals. Now his chief security concern is his country's erasure of cash. He says, you know, this used to be kind of a Luddite issue. And he says, I admit the campaign to preserve cash was once a fringe movement. But he says, Russia's invasions of Ukraine changed everything. People started to realize that it's very easy for Vladimir Putin to switch everything off, not to mention your own government guy, but blow right past that and continue on. And it's not only Putin, he says, it could also be organized crime. Suddenly we have another type of argument. This is interesting. They don't follow at this point. Another group of politicians who are entering the scene. Wish he'd kind of amplified that point, but he doesn't. It doesn't matter, though. He goes on, reliance on digital payments could put the whole nation at risk in the event of a cyber attack or electrical blackout, he adds.
Yep.
The point in all this is that regardless of who you perceive as the bad guy or the bogeyman, everybody's kind of coming to cash. There's a very important role played by cash, and that's what makes that a great story.
Right. Analog, we need analog. We need to rebalance our analog, because the last thing we want is dependency on digital. I was in Sweden for 5 days, and I tried to use cash everywhere I went. Not one place could I find that would take cash. Not one.
The article does talk about that.
Yeah, Sweden is basically lockdown, right?
Yeah, right. That's not good. But let's go to the other side. Like, is crypto and is Bitcoin an answer to this? Can you get around the problem with digital control and Putin or your own government or terrorists or blackouts seizing your money? Let's look at the next story. This is from Bloomberg. Assessing crypto's role in illicit financing. Okay? Here we go. Israel government this week said it had frozen crypto accounts associated with groups such as Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PGI, and PIJ, and others. Another round of wallet freezes in April of this year. Again, we come back to that April when they were bombing Syrian airports. Hamas told its supporters that it would no longer accept crypto donations, a move that Elliptic's David Carlisle said in a blog spot on Wednesday was an acknowledgement of how much the group has lost in seized tokens to date. Around the same time, crypto transactions to the PIJ also dropped significantly, Elliptic data shows. To me, the point of that story is crypto is not so safe. As Israel can just reach in and willy-nilly snap it up, so can your government.
Right. Well, we've seen the FBI seize crypto.
And the DOJ, right.
Right, right.
They just go to the on-ramps and off-ramps where you're trying to get out of your crypto and into cash. They put the cop there and you're busted.
Right.
Good luck.
But the other thing is, I've never, you know, having lived through this and watching what happens when the FBI shows up with a subpoena, you know, to a techie who thinks he's free and independent.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah, you control digital assets by controlling the people who sit at the on and off ramps. And it's amazing how easy it is to do. I mean, it's frightening how easy it is to do, but I've seen it.
Yeah, we kept covering that, you know, over a year ago on Money Markets, when the Fed would go in a case and just subpoena one of the exchanges, and that was the ball game over.
Right, but it doesn't matter whether it's at MasterCard, whether it's at your bank, whether it's crypto, you know, if it's digital, you know, if they can go after a person to control, they can get
it. Right. And I, you know, look, I'm sympathetic to people in crypto and in Bitcoin.
Yeah, but I am too.
I think the impulse is right. Right. But I just think it's insanity to put all your eggs in that basket and overlook cash, which I think.
So I'm coming back to something I keep, you know, I said it in Sweden maybe 100 times. The currency of the future will be relationships of trust. And what's before all of us is how do we figure out, you know, both analog and digital, how to create transaction train tracks which are free and which Mr. Global can't lock down, fiddle with, or destroy. And we're all going to have to do that, whether it's with our sheriffs or our state AGs or, you know, without anybody. And one of the things I love about the crypto guys is they're really working hard to do that. They're trying to figure that out. And you know, something, they have my full and complete appreciation and support. So let's go.
Figure it out.
Let's figure it out, but it's going to have to be analog and digital. An all digital won't work and an all analog won't work. We're going to have to figure out both. And, you know, Pony Express and bicycles, this is going to have an analog component. So
I agree. Yeah, I agree. But let's shift gears and go, speaking of bicycles, we'll change gears and we'll go to change to the lower sprocket and we'll go to Farmageddon. With the story last week, we had him on, although he was just nodded while we were watching Denis Rancourt. But Peter McCullough was in that video. And this week he's here with an article, mRNA booster acceptance trickles to 1.3%. Wow. We've come a long way, he says, from Americans lining up in a fear-driven trance to get their first COVID-19 vaccines in December 2020 to a near complete lack of interest in 2023. Many factors have fed into this enormous change in public sentiment. This one he points to here, Jacobs et al. Reported from the Arizona cohort study that among 2,200 initial vaccine recipients, fewer than 20% took the BA4, BA5 booster shot. So in other words, you're talking about a pool of believers here, 2,200. You only get 20% of them. Natural immunity, side effects, and the lack of efficacy were the main reasons why subjects deferred on injections. Notably, there is no cost, and they are widely available at pharmacies in every town in America, so the decision to decline, quite intentional. And it goes on, here we go, on October 4th, 2023, the Reuters, a news service, indicated that uptake of the new but already outdated XBB 1.5 booster was a paltry 1.3%. It is now very likely that word of mouth on vaccine injuries, disabilities, and deaths has spread to virtually every American. Hallelujah.
Yep.
I hope he's right about that.
If you look at that 4 million, I don't believe those statistics either.
No.
So,
right.
You know.
He's very skeptical of the official statistics and says, you know, that the CDC claims 75% of Americans took one shot. He says, I don't believe that.
I don't believe it. Yeah. The anecdotal evidence suggests less uptake on flu shots on vaccination. A lot of skepticism and concern about trusting hospitals. So I would say the medical establishment and pharmaceuticals are dealing with massive distrust and growing.
Big time. Big time. And they're also, you know, this next story is going to show not so much the medical establishment, so much as the pharmaceutical establishment. Yeah, they're believing their own hubris and they're believing their own hype to their own detriment. The next story is about Pfizer. Let's look at this from Zero Hedge. Pfizer crashes after slashing profit guidance by more than half on collapsing demand for COVID meds. This story is, again, Friday the 13th. Pfizer just lobbed a legendary Friday evening bomb when it slashed its revenue and earnings forecast for the year as it agreed to take returns from the U.S. of its COVID antiviral Paxlovid amid collapsing demand. The company said it now sees 2023 revenue of only $58 billion to $61 billion, so about $60 billion, down $9 billion from its previous estimate of $67 to $70 billion. That's an enormous miss. But as big as that miss is, look at this miss. This is embarrassing. EPS, earnings per share, are now expected to be between $1.45 a share and $1.65 a share, down by more than half from its previous earnings forecast of $3.25 to $3.45. Like, holy cow, that's an epic miss.
Okay, so I want, let's go through the charts on Pfizer, and then I'll make this point, because I want to go back to the Netanyahu syndicate. Because we're just looking at another piece of the Netanyahu-related syndicate.
This is one
crime syndicate.
You're right. Pfizer and Netanyahu are knee-deep together. Right. I think Israel had an exclusive with Pfizer, no?
I don't know the contractual details. What I can say is that Israel was early and a very important prototype, including on how to force people to get these things.
Yeah. Okay, right. So let's go to the charts and take a look at these charts. They're interesting. Total revenue, what are we looking at?
Okay, so this is 2006 to 2022.
Yeah.
And it basically what it shows you in 21 and 22, of course, the bulge from the COVID injections. And, so this was a very big sort of pump for Pfizer, needless to say.
Yeah.
So just go to the next chart and let's take a look at the stock.
Yeah.
Now, this is Moderna and Pfizer. Moderna got, if we were to show a Moderna versus Pfizer chart from the beginning of the injections, you know, Moderna would be so huge in terms of up and down because it was a tiny company with no other business.
It'd be off the scale.
Yeah, it'd be off the scale and Pfizer would just be flat at the bottom. So I don't go back to the beginning. I'm just showing you year to date. So Moderna down much more, not surprisingly. And then Pfizer down, I think it's 37%. Moderna down 50%.
Yeah, it's 36 and change. Moderna is 52%.
And the top line, of course, is the S&P. So it shows you they got quite a pump, outperformed the S&P, and now they're really going down. And of course, despite all the indemnifications and other protections, if you look at what's coming out with the FOIAs and what's coming out with the disability and death, I think there's more than a few investors really worried about Pfizer's financial future and their financial liability. It's serious.
Yeah.
So here's what I want to say about it. It's very important when we look at the war and what's happening in the Middle East. What we're looking at is an operation involving Netanyahu and the American Department of Defense, the American military establishment, right? Okay.
Right. Yep.
The injections were an operation of the U.S. military establishment with Netanyahu being very much in the lead, doing the first hard prototype in Israel, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same group. And what's interesting is, again, Netanyahu and DOD in the lead on how to do, you know, the control grid, how to build the information control grid, how to do the information control grid.
Yeah.
And of course, right. And of course, we know a lot of the 21 trillion went missing across information systems. I'll just say it that way. So it's very important when you look at what's going on with Pfizer to realize if you're Netanyahu, you can really use, I mean, first of all, you need a major distraction because of a million people marching in Israel over the judicial reforms, but your whole syndicate needs a major distraction. I mean, if you're DOD and Netanyahu, and what is coming out on death and disability on the injections is coming out, would you like a major distraction?
I'd love a major distraction, and I would like it not to be named Ukraine, where we're getting waxed.
Right, right. And you need the spigot turned on, right?
Yeah, big time.
Because you've presumably paid a lot of people to play this game, but you need a lot more money to keep it going. So you need the spigot turned on, and you need a major distraction, and you need some way to keep control and keep a lid, not just for yourself, but for the whole syndicate.
I think in a lot of ways, the spigot's got to be on, distraction or not, just because of that interest payment. That's the real, that's a monster.
Right.
The interest payment on U.S. debt. It's over half a trillion now.
So I think the meltdown in the Treasury market and the meltdown in Pfizer stock is an intimate part of what is happening in the Middle East.
Yeah, I have to think that through. I'm not sure about Pfizer stock. Pfizer's in, here's what makes Pfizer such an interesting case.
When I say the meltdown in Pfizer stock, the danger of criminal and civil liability related to the injections that you are seeing in Pfizer's, the meltdown in Pfizer stock.
Yes.
Yeah. In other
it's
words,
not it's not Pfizer stock per se. It's what's behind the
right. So,
the
so we have a syndicate and they're exposed on the injections. They're exposed on the missing money and the meltdown in the Treasury market. And now they could use a war that turns on the spigot and covers all this up.
Yeah, let's have a war. I tell you, the one piece of all of that I always wondered about was, remember Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer, tries to go over to Israel and they won't let him in for a meeting. They're like, hey, you don't have your, you don't have any boosters, and they won't let him in the country. Like,
right.
What?
And you notice he just doesn't go because he's not taking the booster.
Right. And the story was, you don't have your booster. But if you don't have your booster, that story is not, you don't, you had your injection, you had your first one, you didn't have your booster. It's just, you didn't have your booster. Anyway, that was just like, what?
I just, you know, we've got a syndicate here. The syndicate is the problem. And we just need to see, we need to look at the world from their point of view, because if you're Netanyahu, you got a whole bunch of risk issues and a war puts a lid on it. And I would point out, John, that coming up, you know, next week, the movie of the week is going to be Wag the Dog in your honor, because you said you would watch it.
I'll watch it. I'll watch it. We have a break. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's hard to laugh about this, but Wag the Dog will get you to laugh.
I see a lot of references to it now, so I gotta do it. It's time. The time has come for me to punch Wag the Dog.
Okay.
But let's turn to pushback. There's one story this week, but it's a dynamite story. This state to be commending, that state is Texas. This is straight, you know, another official source here. Office of the Texas Governor, Greg Abbott, Operation Lone Star buses over 50,000 migrants to sanctuary cities. That's only really part of the story. But get a load of some of these numbers. What's going on down in Texas? Since the launch of Operation Lone Star, the multi-agency effort has led to over basically 475,000 illegal immigrant apprehensions, 35,000 criminal arrests, of which 32,000 are felonies. Wow. And they seized over 431 million. That's a big number. That's over the U.S. population. 431 million lethal doses of fentanyl during this border mission. Right. Here are the numbers they're talking about with the sanctuary cities. They've shipped over 12,500 to D.C., 18,500 to New York City, 13,500 to Chicago, and then other cities. Unbelievable. And then we come down to another part of the story, which is interesting. We were going to try to run a story on this, but it's hard to come by reliable information. But it's Texas Rangers Special Operations Group reclaims island from cartels. The island they're talking about is Fronton Island. Right. Newsmax border correspondent Jason Jones, embedded with the Texas Rangers Special Operations Group on the 170-acre Fronton Island in the Rio Grande River, for an up-close look at efforts to reclaim the island, not reclaimed it. So not sure what's going on there, from transnational criminal organizations. So the Rio Grande looks something like this, and you've got Mexico here and Texas here, but there's a part where the Rio Grande River does this.
Yep.
And that's the island right there they're talking about.
Right.
And apparently drug cartels were kind of embedded in that island, and now they're not due to what Texas has done. Texas is serious.
Yeah, we talked about this 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, when Texas essentially called a default on the U.S. government, said, you're not protecting us from invasion. And yeah. Now we're gonna take action to do something. And here's why this is important. And I want everyone to just remember this word. The word is disintermediation. Disintermediation. In other words, you know, we are watching an unwinding of going through the federal government for all these different functions. And the state starting to assert jurisdiction. The reason it's so important, John, is Texas has been the leader in doing this, whether it's the power grid or doing a gold bullion depository, you know, or other steps they've taken. And it is emboldening legislators, I know, all over the South, because they're saying, you know something, we are on our own. If we don't do something, we're toast. And I just called down to Tennessee yesterday. One of the complaints we get, and I asked you to read this book, The Great Taking, is concern about whether or not the custodial arrangements at the big securities firms can be trusted. And I called down to Tennessee and I said, could you guys do, you know, Treasury has a Treasury Direct where you invest directly with the Treasury, and Treasury is your custodian instead of your brokerage account. I said, could Tennessee do that? Could you do Tennessee Direct or, you know, Texas Direct or any, and then you're looking to the state to hold your municipal bonds and not your brokerage account.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just floating the idea, but they said, what a great idea. Well, that's disintermediation where you're saying, you know something?
Yeah, right.
I would rather, you know, park my money direct with a horse. If Treasury can do it, why can't a state do it? And you just watch. We are in a slow unwinding as the intermediation gets unwound and unwound and unwound. And this is going to go on for years and years and years.
Yeah, it's sort of the local version of going direct. I mean, disintermediation is a fancy word for let's get rid of a middleman and let's reduce a three-party transaction to a two-party transaction.
Well, I used to go crazy when I was, you know, this is a lot of the work we were doing in the 90s, but you get to the federal government. And when I first became assistant secretary, I did an analysis of, you know, the tax money goes to the federal government and then it comes back through the state and then it goes to the local. And then finally it goes to the beneficiary. And when it started, you know, 70 cents plus on the dollar was going to the guy at the bottom. And by the time I got there, 24 cents was going to the guy at the bottom. And it was all going to third parties, you know, whether federal, state, or local bureaucracies or contractors or, you know, defense contractors who were doing the payment systems. And I can't take, and there was no reason that you couldn't just do it direct and cut them all out. And if you look at the waste in that system, I mean, they're hawking CBDC as a way to cut fees. Hey, no problem. Just cut the federal government out of the whole chain and you can save enormous amounts of money. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's staggering. Right. Yeah.
It's staggering.
Okay. So let's now turn to, really, I think we only have three charts left. This week, because that's it for the stories, that the concluding story with Texas and pushback. So let's move to charts, starting with FinViz. Orange juice again, going insane.
Orange juice is going insane, and you know I have not looked into the orange juice market, but if there's a subscriber who's familiar with the orange juice market, please let us know what is happening.
Other than that, not much. I mean, VIX in the basement again.
Well, slamming the economy, demand destruction through raising interest rates is working.
Raising interest rates is working.
Right.
That's what that chart says.
Right. Yes. And the problem is the people who are feeling the pain are not the ones, you know, if you look at who got the largesse through the pandemics, they're not the one who are getting the pain.
They're enjoying
nice yields on their cash while, you know, the people who got slaughtered during the pandemic are now feeling, you know, another round of pain from the higher interest rates.
Yeah, to be sure. Okay, let's keep it going with the next one.
I just wanted to take a look at the aerospace and defense ETF versus the Israeli ETF. So as you can see, Israeli was outperforming the defense guys, and then this happens and the defense guys are headed up and Israel, you know, really hurting. And I want to, you know, because I'm very worried about the Israeli people, and I just feel like they're pawns in a game and they're in real danger. And one of the problems is real financial stress. So, you know, businesses are not operating or operating, you know, this is not good for business in Israel if you're a business owner or proprietor. No,
look at that split.
Right.
I mean,
right.
they in two different directions, totally different right. charts.
And take a look at the next one, because the currency has dropped by almost a third this year. So this is shekels against the dollar. And so, you know, imagine if our currency dropped against a basket worldwide by a third, John, how much more we'd be paying for our imports. You know, and of course, Israel imports a great deal. So this is very, very painful for the Israeli people and the people of Gaza. So don't underestimate the financial pain of this ridiculousness.
Yeah, that's a lot of pain there. A third in a year, that's a huge number.
Right. And the reason I talk about we're all in the kill zone is when you allow a criminal syndicate to run your government, these are the things that happen.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not their concern.
Right. And that's why in 1998, I said, I'm out. I don't want to be part of this. But
yeah.
What can I tell you?
Good for you. You are where you are. You're still alive, too.
I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, there miracles happen. Okay,
let's dive,
let's dive into Solari.
Okay,
well, you know,
we
it's funny. I work for the best group of people. I mean, if you look at who I work for compared to who I used to work for, I'm in heaven.
Right.
So,
right. I am too. You know, I'm out. Yeah, our hero of the week, Pierre Corey.
Dr. Pierre Corey, you know, rocketed to fame with his work on ivermectin during the what one of our allies calls the COVID circus. And I just, you know, I'd met him briefly at a conference several years ago, but I met him. He came to Sweden, and oh my God, what a fabulous man. So he, among other things, he led the auction. And I told him, I said, Pierre, you know, if you get tired of being a doctor, he started a private practice and is doing great, great things. And he you know, it was very interesting, John. He stepped back and he said, I miss patients. That's what I love to do. I love caring for people. And so he dove straight in and he said, I'm going to help anybody who's vaccine injured. And so he's made a real specialty of who, you know, of people who've been vaccine injured and what can help. And, you know, and that is a very hard job. So, anyway, but he did the auction for, we were raising money for the groups that had sponsored it, for Doctors Appeal and Children's Health Defense Europe. And I told him afterwards, he did such a fabulous job. I said, Pierre, if you ever get tired of being a doctor, I'm from Hickory Valley, Tennessee, and we have opportunities in livestock auction for you. So he's something else. Anyway, so Pierre Corey, a great doctor and really a true hero.
True hero. Yeah. Awesome. Okay, let's go to the next one. I'm interested. Meet Catherine. Join Catherine.
So we had a lot of subscribers coming to the Weston Price Conference in Kansas City. It starts, I'll fly out on tomorrow, and I'll be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Anyway, they said they wanted to meet up, and we said, okay, and we got a room. You get a buffet, so you get, if you're going to the conference, you get your lunch during a buffet, so everybody gets their buffets and goes down to the room. So the subscribers wanted to meet up, and I thank you for the inspiration, so we're going to be doing that on Saturday during lunch.
That's a menacing looking building there, Barber Hall. Wow.
You know,
they must have got the architect for the BIS there.
Well, you know, the BIS is building a new building. So I told you the story. I was in Basel and I was driving past the BIS and I said to a friend of mine, I said, you know, given the Iron Bank in Game of Thrones, if I was Basil, if I was the BIS, I would build a new headquarters because this is not a good look. You really do look like the Iron Bank.
They said,
they are. Didn't you know they're building a new headquarters?
Yeah, it's like you said, you got to put the velvet glove over the iron fist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not an iron glove over the iron.
Yeah,
fist.
No, it looks like the Iron Bank. So apparently they're changing their look. I haven't seen it, so we'll see.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep it going. Blast from the past.
So one of the things I heard from Sweden and people who are working with vaccine injured people is that fasting really, really helps. And the best book I've ever read on fasting. Yeah. Well, fasting's great for detox, but, you know, but you really need to, you know, you can't just do it. You really need to, you know what there's a science to fasting. There's an art and a science. And this is the best book I've ever found on fasting by Jason Fung. It's quite good. So we wanted to bring that up on the Blast from the Past.
Okay. I mean, how long are we talking about without food?
You know, there are different ways of doing it. You can do intermittent fasting, which is not a complete fasting, and you can do short periods and long periods. So, you know, I didn't get into the details of how long they recommended, but I think my experience, because I've done a lot of detoxing in my life, is everybody's different. You have to find your own way. So you have to try things and find out what works for you.
Yeah. That is so true.
Right.
I've spent the last year figuring out the right exercise regimen. And it's a lot of work to get the right balance because it affects your sleep so much.
Right. But to me, the number one best way to lose weight is to go ride a bicycle across the country.
Yeah. That's helped me a lot, but it's not only that anyway.
Yeah.
Let's keep it on. Last in-house, so Larry here with Farrell. What are we? AI.
Yeah. So part two, we decided we would change the format and do all of part two on unanswered questions. And this is a great conversation because Farrell was in a great mood and he just let it rip. He's got a really new, interesting book that I'm reading. It took me months to get a copy, but this gets very interesting and deep because we just go through all the unanswered questions. So it's, as Joseph would say, it's high octane speculation. Our theme for this wrap up is Artificial Intelligence by Whitney Webb. And I just read the first part of it. She's been working on the draft. She has sickness and her son has been sick. So so we're going to publish it later than we had expected, but it's a doozy and it's going to bring you right back to what's going on in Israel, which you won't be surprised.
Wow.
Right.
Because
guess what cyber, you know, what syndicate wants to be in the lead on artificial intelligence, right?
Well, certainly the U.S., but also Israel. Those two are going to be right there neck and neck.
I also want to mention, I just spoke before I got on to record with you, John. I just spoke with Mike Robinson from UK Column, who's one of the great, in my opinion, one of the great new media people. And he just led a symposium with CHD Europe last night on 5G. And they got the world's best, including Frank Clegg, who used to run Microsoft in Canada, who's like unbelievable on this topic. And we'll put up the live stream, or we'll put up the individual videos aren't available yet, but the full one video is available. We'll put it up on Solari, but you can also get it on UK Column. And if you're interested in this topic, and of course, it'll bring you right back to the syndicate we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're busy. They're busy beavers, that group.
I'll tell you who else is big in AI is China, and they have been a long time. Yep.
Yeah. So a book I recommend, we did a book review a couple of years ago, is AI Superpowers. And it's about the fact that the U.S. and China is way in the lead. And when I say U.S., that's with Israel. They're way in the lead and everybody else is so far behind. And what's unbelievable, if you look at the economics of the emerging markets, China is and Asia is growing dramatically, but the rest of the emerging markets are being totally left behind.
Wow.
You know, both in economic growth and technology. And there's a real, talk about a divide, there's a real division going on that's pretty scary, in my opinion. So.
Yeah.
On that cheery note.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. So our theme is keep calm.
Keep calm and carry on in the kill zone.
In the kill zone. And so my advice to everybody is anything you can do to lower, you know, to bring calm and peace. Kelly and me used to have a sticker on the back of her car saying peace in this world and let it start with me.
Yeah.
Anything we can do to bring, you know, to
reduce calm heat, reduce heat, increase light.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depend on electrical engineer to be able to say it just right.
Those are the days.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. You have a great week. And we'll be back next week, right?
I don't think so.
No, we're off next week. Is that?
Yeah, 19th, 20th. Yeah, we're now.
Yeah,
no next week.
We're no next week. So
I will see you, Catherine, in a fortnight.
Yeah. And you know something, John, I think we're going to have a lot to talk about.
No, I can't believe it. We did a good job this week of keeping it tight. So
yeah. Yeah.
We're going to need to really kick into that gear next time, though.
Okay.
2 weeks. Okay.
Yep.
All right. See ya.
Bye.